The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So first I'll ask if you can hear me okay. Yes, so for those of you who don't know, there are hearing-assisted devices on the counter right outside this door here in the social hall if you need them. And scheduled today was Maria Stratman, and she called me last night. Unfortunately, she has a fever and is not feeling well and thought it was best not to be here when she's sick. So when she called me and said, "Diana, can you teach tomorrow?" my initial reaction was, "Oh, great, because I can share something that I've been finding a lot of delight in, something I've been finding kind of inspired by, and it's an opportunity for me to share with others." So I hope that maybe I can make this infectious, this sense that I've been having recently. And this is about some reading that I've been doing, particularly about some poetry. Don't worry, I'm not going to read you lots of long poems or something like this, but part of what I think makes poetry really special or interesting or meaningful is that it often is pointing towards something that is maybe out of our ordinary experience, something special, something that resonates with us, maybe with something deep within inside us, something that is, I don't know, true, or something that is settled or feels whole or feels clear, something like that that's inside of us. I don't know exactly what it is. And maybe that's why we have poetry, is to kind of just point towards something rather than explaining exactly what it is. But of course, it's not only poetry that points towards these things. It's all kinds of art, music, dance. When I was thinking about this, I remembered that many years ago, I had the opportunity to go see a performance of that was a like a play of the life of Janis Joplin. Some of you may know, right? She was very popular a couple of decades ago, and she was a very, very powerful singer and had a very colorful life. And so this performance had two women, one that was doing the singing of Janis Joplin and was singing her songs that she was well known for, and the other was doing the acting, the kind of acting out parts of her life as well as narrating it. So something that really struck me about this performance, I found myself in the audience with tears coming down my face just because these women were so powerful in the way that they were portraying this story. I, of course, don't know exactly what was going on in their minds, but their experience was that they were just giving it their all. They were completely present and were sharing with us these songs and sharing with us with this the story. They were performing in a way that was just exquisite. And I felt really touched by that. I felt touched by their skill and their generosity in sharing it in kind of like a complete way. And something inside me resonated with that. Maybe you've had a similar experience too. Also, I was thinking about sometimes when we see athletes who are really at the top of their game and really know what they're doing, is the same type of experience. For me, I used to do gymnastics when I was really young, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. I did gymnastics and I loved it as a young girl. My mom would take me to gymnastics practice. But now as an adult, I love to watch, when the Olympics come around, you know, the gymnastics. There's something really amazing about their ability and their skill. But also, I imagine that they are in the present moment giving their all as well. So with sports and art kind of point towards something that is different than our ordinary experience, different than the usual way of being. Maybe not the usual concerns that we have or preoccupations that we have, a freedom from those types of things that that we get tangled up with, that we find ourselves maybe stuck with, whether that's recursive thoughts. Oh, I shouldn't have said that. Now that I said that, she's going to think this. Oh, I shouldn't have said that. If only I had said this. Oh, I really shouldn't have said that. I should have said that. Why did I say that? I shouldn't have said this. Right? I think all of us have this experience of getting a little bit stuck, kind of just going around and around and around with something and feeling like, oh, this isn't exactly what I want to be doing, but here I am doing this, going round and round. So not only art or maybe watching other people who are very skilled or very or just present giving their all point to a certain type of experience, but also maybe during meditation we've had these experiences as well. Maybe it's not our dominant experience, but maybe there has been a time when we have been just collected on the breath. And there's a sense of relief. Oh, putting down some of the usual things that concern us, putting down those things that weigh us down. And maybe we don't even know that we're weighed down until we feel that little bit of relief. And then it's not that we put them down forever, perhaps, but just like when we let go of something that's very heavy and burdensome, when we pick it up again after having let go, maybe we've have it renewed energy, a renewed point of view to look at it. Maybe we've had an opportunity to catch our breath, so to speak. So with meditation, sometimes if we have the opportunity, maybe if it's just one breath, maybe if it's just half of a breath, to bring all those different parts of ourselves and just rest there on that half of a breath, that also is pointing towards something that is possible, a non-ordinary way of being, where we're free from our preoccupations, free from those things that vex us, free from those things that we consider problems and troubling. So it's this pointing towards something special that I found this really delight in these particular poems. I felt inspired by them, not only because I think that they're beautiful poetry, but as it happens, they're Buddhist poems that talk about liberation. One thing that they talk about is, what is the experience of awakening like? What is it like to be enlightened? Whether it's to be an arhat, to be a Buddha, to be completely enlightened, or what is it like to have those moments, just perhaps a moment, of something that's a little different. It's not the ordinary experience. We've put down, however brief a moment, but we've put down the usual way of being. Another reason why these poems, I feel touched by them, is that they're all written by women. And for me, I'm a woman, of course, and I, you know, sometimes just like to see things that are written by other women and to kind of celebrate that their contributions and what they have to teach us and to show us and to the way that they describe their experience, just so that we can have all voices in the room, not just men, not just women, but all voices. And then something else about these poems that I find kind of quite amazing is that they're old. They were composed quite a while ago. In fact, over 2,000 years ago. So for me to kind of think about what does 2,000 years mean, if we think about a generation is about 25 years, that's 500 generations of women before us, five generations of families before us, where they're describing their experience, their awakening experience, and how they got there, how it came to be that they had this awakening experience. So these poems come from a collection that's called the Terigata. This is a collection of poems that are in the Pali Canon, that is the Buddhist literature that is considered the scriptural and foundation for this tradition. So it's part of our heritage in this tradition. They're also considered the world's oldest poems that are written by women. And they've been translated a number of times. Most recently, a new translation came out just a few months ago, and that happens to be why I've been looking at it. So maybe I'll start with the first poem. It's really short, and I can't help smile whenever I read this. And hopefully this you'll smile as well. So freed, so freed, so thoroughly freed am I from my pestle, my shameless husband and the sunshade he worked under, my moldy old pot with its water snake smell, aversion and greed I cut with a chop. Having come to a foot of a tree, I meditate, absorbed in the bliss. What bliss! Right? This feels like a certain delight. Here is somebody who has found something really special, right? She's really touched by this. The poem, it starts and ends with exclamation, so freed, what bliss, right? So maybe, I don't know if we ever feel that degree of happiness or joy. I hope sometimes we do, right? But here's some of this kind of celebrating that. And then she talks about what is she freed from. She's freed from household chores, perhaps. This a relationship with a spouse that perhaps isn't all that she wished it were. From aversion, this pushing away. And from greed, this pulling. When those things have been put aside and she's able to meditate, she feels bliss. So maybe I should say that these poems, a part of the reason why they've been preserved for millennia, right, for us, is that they were written by, or composed, I should say, by nuns. So these were from the first Buddhist nuns. So these are women who have chosen to renounce the conventional lifestyle of ancient India. We don't know exactly what ancient India was like, but I feel confident in saying they probably didn't have centers like IMC, right, where you can come and meditate and meet with others and hear teachings or be in community. They didn't have podcasts and books, right? So that teachings that were readily available when you feel like it or when you wanted to or with different teachers that you have a resonance with. Ancient India, of course, didn't have modern medicine. So it's very likely that everybody knew somebody that had died or knew a family of somebody who had died. Infant mortality probably was different than it is now. So the experience, the heartbreak of having a children, of having a child die, of having children die, that probably was not unknown. And also family structures were most likely different. Not that we all now live in the leave it to beaver type style life, but back then, most marriages were arranged and they were more alliances between families or something other than love and affection would bring people together. So they may find a life, you know, the family life very different than here. And then one last thing, ancient India also had limited alternatives or opportunities for things to be different. It wasn't like a person could go off to college and learn a different trade and not go into the family business. It's not that they could go off on retreat for a week and put the usual concerns aside and just focus on their meditation practice or their spiritual practice. There were very, very few opportunities outside of the usual societal structures then. That just, you know, the way that it was then. So renunciation, becoming a nun or becoming a monk, was one of the few alternatives to the usual life. Maybe it was the only alternative to the usual life, unlike now, where there's many ways that we can practice without having to ordain, that we can renounce without having to become a person who wears robes and goes for alms rounds. I know for me, this has been a big part of my life. I used to be happily working in corporate America. I thought I was happily enough until I felt like there's got to be more to this, getting up, going to work, worried about, you know, this and doing that and thinking I have to do the best and timelines and deadlines and meetings and feeling like, wow, is there something more? And then as I had a certain amount of success, enough success in my professional life that I could see, like, oh, more of this is going to be more of this. So I decided to change my life. I know this opportunity is not available to everybody, nor do it's recommended for everybody, but that's a type of renunciation, a type of putting aside kind of the usual way of doing things and choosing to do something different. And now I live a very different life, much simpler, much, very different. So rather than having to ordain, I've done something a little bit different. And now, I'm not sure how this happened, I find myself sitting up here talking to you. Getting back to this poem, though, so this person, she's has put aside kind of the usual way of doing things, but also she's put aside something that we hear about a lot in Dharma talks and teachings, aversion and greed, this way of being tangled up with things, whether it's a pushing away, I don't want this, or a greed, a pulling away, I do want this. Both of those ways are ways that we're not able to put things down. Part of this getting stuck and going around and around is the aversion and the greed kind of fuel the, I'm using this word, entanglement, the getting stuck with things. And there's another poem that talks about where this person has this awakening experience when she least expects it. I found this one very touching. This one's very short. This is also about a nun wandering about for alms, weak, leaning on a stick with limbs shaking. I fell to the ground, right there, and seeing the danger in the body, my mind was freed. So here is where something completely unexpected happened. She falls. And something in that moment that when when she sees that her body that she's been relying on, even though she's now for illness or age, we don't know why, she's no longer able to walk so well. She needs a stick and is trembling, right? She falls. And in that moment, she sees, oh, I've been, all this hope that I had for my body, all this identification I had with my body, here we go again. It has failed me. It has not done what I had hoped it was doing. I was hoping that I was going to walk and get some alms and get my meal for the day. Instead, we fell. And in that moment, kind of seeing clearly that the body, our preoccupation with it, our concern with it, is not where freedom is. It's not the way where we can find the most ease. Certainly our bodies are a part of the practice, but the getting tangled up with them again, that's not where the freedom is. And it takes something drastic like this, being falling to the ground when she's able to see it and freedom arises. I feel kind of touched by this because it's very striking that it's not the ordinary way of doing things. It's not the perfect sitting in meditation with nothing but happiness and bliss, right? And then you become awakened. Here's something, a person who is really, it's not easy, I imagine, to walk with limbs shaking. It's not easy to go for alms, maybe carrying your bowl in one hand and having a walking stick in the other. And yet she does it, and this is her way that she finds freedom. And then a third poem that I'd like to talk about is attributed to Mahaprajapati. It's kind of a long name, but maybe it'll be familiar to some of you because it's written on the plaque out there in the social hall underneath the statue as the first Buddhist nun. Mahaprajapati is the person who went to the Buddha probably 5 or so years after the Buddha himself gained awakening and said, you know, it would be nice if there was a nun's order, just like there is a monk's order. She probably didn't say it exactly like that, but maybe she did, right? We don't know. And eventually, she became the first nun, the very first nun. She was the one who started this, to have Buddhist nuns. And after her, there have been many, many nuns. So here's a woman who changed the course of history. She went to the Buddha, who was a very powerful person, and said, you know, I'd like things to be a little bit different, sir. May we please change it? For those of you who know the story, it wasn't, you know, the Buddha didn't immediately say yes, and it wasn't straightforward necessarily, but it did happen. There was the beginning of the nun's order. So Mahaprajapati is known for that. She's also known for a second thing. She was actually the Buddha's foster mother. She raised the Buddha. He wasn't a Buddha yet when he was a boy. Gotama was his name. Gotama. Gotama is the, if we want to be technical about Pali, was how we would pronounce it, but Gotama, I think, is how a lot of us in English pronounce it. Gotama's mother, Maya, also called Mahamaya. Maha means great, so the great Maya. She died right after the Buddha-to-be was born. So the Buddha was raised by Maya's sister, Mahaprajapati. So this also happens to be the Buddha's aunt. So she raised him from a baby, from an infant, from a newborn, until he was a young man and chose to leave the life that he had before then, for those of you who know the life story of the Buddha. So Mahaprajapati has a big role in kind of the Buddhist tradition and the Buddhist story, not only for being the first nun ordained by the person that she had raised, but also by being the first mother, the person that cared for Gotama, and also the first mother that probably watched a son leave the palace life, leave the life that he had to try to do something different. I think maybe now we send our sons and our daughters off to college, so maybe it's not such an unusual experience. Or they, you know, they leave home for a number of reasons. But back then, that may have been a more unusual occurrence to leave the usual life, you know, for a child to leave and for the family, for the parents to have to say goodbye. So I'm going to, before I read this, I'll also say that Mahaprajapati, in her poem, she mentions rebirth. And we can hold rebirth in a number of ways. In my view, we can hold it in a way that makes sense to us, inspires our practice, resonates with something deep inside of us, makes sense, consistent with our experience. We can understand rebirth in whichever way makes sense to us. that may be taking it literally, that after our death, we are born again into another life, and then we have that life, and then we have re-death, rebirth, re-death, rebirth, re-death, around and around and around. In ancient India, that was the predominant belief, I believe it was. I'm pretty sure it was. And that was a concern of a lot of people at that time. But we could also hold it as a, rather than being reborn as a new individual in a subsequent life, it could be reborn in a different role or a different aspect. This morning, I was that weird person that was walking along talking to herself. So I was getting ready, talking to you guys this morning. I went for a walk. Right now, I'm the person that's sitting up here giving a Dharma talk. Later, I'll be the person that, I'll be a dishwasher as I clean up the dirty dishes I left in the sink this morning. Right, so I'm kind of reborn as all these different ways. So that's another way we can hold rebirth. But whichever way we think about rebirth, I think one thing that it points to, again, this is what I pointed to earlier, is this idea of being stuck, of being going around and around and around. Wanting things to be a little bit different, not quite sure how to make them different, and yet in watching ourselves doing the same thing over and over. I know I was in a long-term relationship and I found myself having the same argument over and over again with my partner. The details were different, but it kind of always felt like the same argument, like, oh, are we really going to do this again? Here we go. Okay. You know, and kind of feeling the unpleasantness of it, but not quite being able to get out of it and watching myself do this. You know, so that type of sense of doing things over and over that's not satisfying is not the way we want to do things. A second aspect of rebirth that we can think about is it denotes a sense of time. It means that things are happening repeatedly. It means that they happen over a long time. It's not just a moment. Whether it's multiple lifetimes that go on for millennia, which sometimes in the Buddhist teachings they talk about, or whether it's years with the same job or the same partner, same life, whatever it is, that idea of rebirth is just the sense of it taking a long time, things going through time. So now I'd like to read a little bit of Mahaprajapati's poem. And for me, this something that's really beautiful about this and inspiring about this is she describes also how she got there. How was it that she could become awakened? And I think that you'll see in here, it's not in the usual exact way that we're used to hearing it, but we'll find some things in here that are very familiar to us. And those of us who practice here at IMC and that have been hearing Dharma talks here, she talks about the same things that are taught here. For me, I find inspiration in that. You know, it's that it, like proof, oh, here, it works. Here's somebody that is saying it. So she's talking to the Buddha in the beginning of this, in this poem. And then she's maybe just talking in general. Praise to you, hero among Buddhas, best of all beings. You freed me from suffering, just as you did so many other people. All suffering is known. The craving that is suffering's cause has been destroyed. The eightfold path of the noble ones has been traveled, and cessation reached. I had already been a mother, a son, a father, a brother, and a grandmother. But not knowing things as they really are, I was reborn and reborn, never having enough. As soon as I saw the Buddha, I knew that this is my last body. The realm of births is finished. Now there is no more rebirth for me. When I look at the disciples assembled together, energetic, resolute, always making an effort, I see that this is how Buddhas are rightly honored. Mahamaya gave birth to Gotama for the sake of many, to drive away the massive suffering of all those struck down by sickness and death. So I think in this simple poem by Mahaprajapati, composed, attributed to the first Buddhist nun, a mere 2,000 years ago, has almost all of the key Buddhist teachings in here. Something really wonderful. She starts with the beginning, kind of like praise to the Buddha. She has a, you freed me from suffering. Maybe I'll take a little aside here. Suffering, right, is the word for dukkha. It doesn't have to mean grand suffering. It can mean just that inkling little sense of something's not quite right. Maybe we're not even sure what it is, you know, just that something's not quite right. I wish something were just a little bit different. Sometimes we call that stress. Sometimes we call that, Lee Brazenton calls it bummer. that kind of sense, things just aren't quite right. So suffering, perhaps many of you, if you've been coming here, know this, that suffering is a big, complicated word. It doesn't have to mean the big, giant suffering. Praise to you, you freed me from suffering, just as you did so many other people. So, right, she kind of like has gratitude and for something, somebody that has helped her find some freedom, helped her find some ease. Maybe she also had this bliss that the other poem that we heard about was in there. In the same way, I certainly feel a lot of gratitude that places like IMC exist, that I can come here and practice, that I come here and be hear the teachings, and I can be part of the community here, and that I it's an opportunity for me to practice service and generosity, too, to be here. So I can relate to the sense of gratitude for those things that are in my life that have made a difference, that have enabled me to do things a little bit differently than I might have otherwise. And then this next part is probably familiar to many of us. Suffering is known. The craving that is suffering's cause has been destroyed. The Eightfold Path of the Noble Ones has been traveled. And cessation has been reached. Right? This is the Four Noble Truths. We can recognize this as kind of a foundational teaching that we talk about in so many different ways and so many different aspects of it here at IMC and Buddhists all over the, through the millennia and through the different countries too have been talking about this. So here is somebody who is liberated who is talking about the same thing, who is saying that she knows what it means to destroy the cause of suffering. She knows what it's like to have the cessation of suffering. For her, it's not just a teaching, but it's actually an experience that she has had. And of course, she's talking about the Eightfold Path, too, because that's the Fourth Noble Truth. And like even here at IMC, we have the Eightfold Path program. It's a 9-month program where you can participate. And for 1 month is one path factor. So this is on the second year, and I'll probably start again for a third year. It's a great opportunity for people to really engage with the Eightfold Path in their life in many different ways. And she says, I'd already been a mother, a son, a father, a brother, and a grandmother. Right? These are many different ways of being in the world, whether it's the authoritative one or whether it's the subordinate one. Whether it's the grandmotherly one that's, oh, yep, I know, I've seen that. And who just has love and care for others, rather than firsthand having to raise the children, knows what it's like to, isn't maybe so concerned about like how grandparents are. They've already had children, right? So unlike parents who may be really concerned about the small things, grandparents often know like, oh, it's okay if the baby eats that thing that fell on the floor, or right, you know, those types of things. But not knowing things as they really are, I was reborn and reborn, never having enough. So again, that points to kind of the greed that we saw in the first poem, is that was the first poem was able to put that aside, and that led to awakening. But here, she's pointing that she couldn't see that greed was part of the what was keeping her tangled up and keeping her stuck. And then with the sense of rebirth. And also, I like this part too, when she says, I look at the disciples assembled together, energetic, resolute, always making an effort. The importance of community, of other people practicing together, that's part of why we're here, right? Not just sitting at home on a Sunday morning, of why we come to meditate together, either with support, or for me sometimes it was just peer pressure that kept me on my cushion, right? When I'd rather would have gotten up and bolted. And that they, and this community is practicing together with energy, with a resolution, with a, maybe collectively, maybe not everybody as an individual at the time, but collectively, they had the forbearance, the perseverance to continue practicing, even when it was difficult or unpleasant or confusing or not what we had wished for. And then she, the last stanza, Mahamaya gave birth to Gotama for the sake of many. So here's a woman who has experienced liberation. What comes to mind is her sister, Mahamaya, who at this time had died decades earlier. But I think this is true for all of us, that when something wonderful happens or something amazing or happens, we often want to share it with others, or we bring to mind those people who are not, who aren't with us, either because they're elsewhere or because they have died, whether it's something like a wedding or a birth or a, you know, some other big occasion. We often bring to mind those people who aren't with us. So I feel touched by this, though. Here is a woman who has gained awakening, and she's still thinking about her sister, who died probably 30 years earlier, that brings to mind. So in this a single poem attributed to Mahaprajapati, we find, I think, so much about Buddhist practice. So much about how to practice and what is possible, and that it is possible. And I think that she is pointing towards something with her words, as well as with the fact that this is poetry, with the way that it's said, to something inside us that's not the ordinary experience, not the usual way of doing things. And maybe I'll end with this excerpt of another poem, because we may ask, well, okay, so these women knew how to practice, they had these achievements, they were able to share them, but how? How did they do it? How did they know how to practice, and how were they able to do so? Here's an excerpt from one of them. The Buddha commended having good friends for anyone, anywhere in the universe. By keeping company with good friends, even a fool becomes wise. Keep company with good people. Wisdom increases for those who do. By keeping company with good people, one is freed from every suffering. One should know suffering, the origin of suffering, and its cessation, and the Eightfold Path. Right, so here again, we see the end, the last stanza, one should know suffering, origin, cessation, Eightfold Path. We recognize this as the Four Noble Truths. And here, this nun, she's saying that we practice the Four Noble Truths, we know the Four Noble Truths by being associated with good friends. And the word in Pali here is Kalyanamitta, right? We have this expression here that these are the, when we have a group of practitioners that come together, we call them a Kalyanamitta. So here she's pointing to the role they have, the importance they have in learning to practice and practicing together. So for me, I found a certain delight in reading these. I felt inspired by them, that they're describing that it's possible to become awakened. I'm interpreting it awakened as can be, you know, becoming an arhat, as well as just those little moments when we have clarity, just those little moments when we can put down our usual preoccupations, or whatever's preventing us from being completely clear, whatever's preventing us from being completely in the moment. And with that, I wish you that you can find something that's inspiring and supports your practice and points towards the goodness, the possibility that's within all of us. And that may the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path support you. And may the good friends, and wherever we may find them, whether it's at the potluck that's going to happen as soon as I stop talking, or whether it's with your family members, or maybe it's just by coming to practice here in community with IMC. I wish that for all of you. So, thank you.